Everyone loves a good success story. A talented and scrappy young person with a humble start who pushes through hardship and adversity, discovers their true ability, and achieves great success. It's the American dream. And if we believe that story, we can all have it, but we might not all pay the same price.
Achievement and safety are really sort of interwoven in that way, that if you can just get that degree or get that accolade, that somehow you might be a little bit safer from the ravages of racism and systemic bias.
The world I lived in didn't have a lot of room for a Mexican kid, so I tended to sort of not embrace my heritage. In my mind, the environment forced me to do that, and I regret having to do that.
I'm Brian Lowry, professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. In this season of Know What You See, I talk to people from a wide range of backgrounds about their experiences with race and power. Growing up, my mother was a primary school teacher, and my father worked for the phone company. He started going out and doing repairs in the field, climbing telephone poles, going to people's homes to check their wiring. And from that, he worked his way into management. And now, their son, me, is a professor at Stanford. My family story, told this way, sounds like a clear path to the American dream. These days, we are much clearer on the obstacles to the American dream. What's less clear is how identity shapes what the American dream means and the price paid to strive for it. Today, I talk with Julia Collins and Oscar Munoz, both incredibly accomplished business people, but who took different paths to success that often took them to places where their identities meant people didn't see them as they saw themselves.
Hi, Brian. I'm Julia Collins. I'm the founder and CEO of Planet Forward. Our company's on a mission to help tackle climate change by making it easier to bring climate-friendly products to market. We build both snacks and software that are all designed to promote climate-friendly eating and carbon-neutral manufacturing processes.
Can you tell me a little bit about why food?
Yeah, it really began for me as a little girl growing up very close to my grandparents. My grandparents on my father's side migrated from the South during the Great Migration, you know, which was this time when millions of Black people moved from the South to the North, primarily to take advantage of new economic opportunities. My grandparents were originally from South Carolina and West Virginia, but they met at Meharry Medical School when my grandpa was studying to be a dentist, and my grandma was studying to be a dental hygienist. And so, you know, in that migration, they carried with them their folkways and their foodways. And when they arrived in San Francisco, which was a heavily segregated city, to start this dental practice, they actually came from the perspective that they were building the practice for the Black community, but that everyone was welcome. So I've just always believed, Brian, that, you know, the best moments in life, you know, the ones where people feel the most welcome and the most human, are when we're sharing food together.
So given your deep connection to food, what was the deal with the biomedical engineering?
One of the things that happens when you come from, you know, a family that's had to fight so hard for so many generations, and this is true for people who are, you know, immigrants to our country. This is true for people who identify as Black. This is true for many people for different reasons. But when you come from kind of a history of struggle, there's a real focus for the current generation on achievement. And I think a lot of that is a desire for your parents and your grandparents to just help you achieve some measure of safety. Because life for them and for the people that came before them was not safe. And so achievement and safety are really sort of interwoven in that way. That if you can just get that degree or get that accolade, that somehow you might be a little bit safer from the ravages of racism and systemic bias. So in my case, you know, from the time I was a little kid, I wanted to go to Harvard. I was just so sure that I had to go to Harvard, you know. And then when it came time to apply to Harvard, you know, it was like, what's the most impressive thing I could possibly study when I get to Harvard, you know? Okay, it's it's got to be engineering, and then not just engineering, it's got to be biomedical engineering. So, and I realized very shortly that that wasn't for me. Wound up finishing in government with a special focus on African American studies, and that's when I really felt like I started to find something closer to my true calling.
The concern for safety might sound strange coming from Julia's family. Her father was a dentist, and she had what sounds like a relatively comfortable upbringing. But that was no guarantee of security.
My name is Oscar Munoz, and I am a recently retired chairman and CEO of United Airlines.
The stakes are even higher when you start on a lower social and economic rung. The experiences that came with his humble beginnings stayed with him.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, a family of nine, Mexican-American heritage. Dad was a blue-collar worker, meat cutter. My mom stayed at home and raised us kids. We didn't have a lot as far as material things, but there was always a lot of fun and laughter. My dad was thoughtful enough to move us from the inner city to a more suburban place where we were the only Munozes, as you can imagine. And so all the experiences I've had throughout my life, with my journey to this country, as an immigrant, every person who's influenced me, I've carried all that with me wherever I go. It frankly does shape you as how you approach problems, how I lead others and the decisions I make. And so it's just an amazing process.
When you come from a place of insecurity, the first measure of success is often safety, which means financial resources. Fear of falling is not an idle concern.
When you actually look at the data, you see that in fact, rates of intergenerational mobility are not the same for blacks and whites. They're quite different.
Here's Raj Chetty, professor of economics at Harvard University, talking about economic mobility in an online lecture.
The way I think about it kind of visually is, if you think of achieving the American dream as climbing an income ladder for white Americans, it's more like being on a treadmill for black Americans, right? So even after you climb up in one generation and escape poverty, unfortunately, there's tremendous downward pressure on income such that you have a very high probability of falling back down into the middle class or the lower class and then kind of have to make that climb again.
Clearly, concern for financial stability is real, but there's got to be more to success than just making money. So I'm curious, do you feel safe now?
When I think about, am I safe? It's like, are we safe? Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge amount of tenderness that I feel as a black mother around the safety of my partner, his safety, the safety of my sons. And I recognize that the world is not safe for them in many ways. So it's interesting, as an individual, if I just think about Julia and my day-to-day life, I live a really privileged and beautiful life in many ways. But when I extend that to my family and I see what's happening in the world, I don't know that we are safe.
You've worked really hard. You've achieved success by many measures and still have that experience of uncertainty or a lack of safety for the people you love and care about is tough.
The idea of whether or not I'm safe by sort of other metrics, you know, like, will I be accepted? You know, will I be successful? I think as I've just gotten older, you know, I'm now 42. I think as I've gotten older, I just feel increasing levels of confidence and just alignment within myself that make me experience those things differently. So I don't worry so much about being accepted or being successful or doing good work because I've had time to sort of work through those things.
It's not just that we like success stories. We need them. We need them to maintain the faith that success is possible for everyone. And to feel pride in our accomplishments. We want to feel like we deserve what we have. But this faith is incomplete if it only sees outcomes. We often look away from differences in what was required to achieve success, differences in prices that people paid. In a world that doesn't know what it's seeing when it looks at you, economic success can come at a significant cost to the individual. You can be at the pinnacle of your career, an incredible success in almost everybody's eyes, but still face issues of safety and acceptance. Here's Oscar again.
Unfortunately, when you have positions of the kind of public nature that, let's say, my last role was, it can be a little treacherous because all of us know that who are of a different mix. If you say something strongly about your heritage or immigration, in my case, they look at you and it's like, of course, you know, a Munoz would say that. know, back when I was in my 20s, the concept of racial equality, diversity, inclusion, all of that was not a thought. None of us as humans know that we are any different than anyone else until someone rubs it in your face. Young children play and have a wonderful time. They're unaffected by political or any other viewpoints that have been shared with them. And so you live blissfully on, and then invariably there comes that one day and that one situation where somebody says something and you're just defenseless. You're just defenseless.
Think about a time when you were the only person of your identity in the room. What does it take to be the only one? Imagine walking into work each day bringing your history and experiences and knowing that much of that cultural knowledge, stuff that you grew up with, that you value, is not shared or understood, or in some situations, even respected.
Didn't see a lot of people in my initial world that looked a lot like me. And so you would get certain commentary from senior people when you would go in and talk with them. They'd say things like, you're probably going to have to work a little harder because people are not going to recognize your value intrinsically, where other people would get things. You have the experiences that we've all had as people of color. I've had people hand me towels at a resort as they were going back to their room. You have all those crazy things. You've had, senior level board members at one of my corporations citing that I got noticed as I forget what designation was about, Hispanic leadership in corporate America. And he came up to me, clapped his arm on me, goes, "Oh, that's so good that we get credit for that." I was like, "What do you mean by that?" And the thought was that, sure, you're a Munoz, but you're not like the other. It's like that whole awkward conversation.
You're different. Than those other ones.
And to possibly understand that you may have to work a little harder and that there's going to be some unfairness in the process. But over time, you overcome. And I reference as the first and frankly only Latino to ever run a major airline in this country. I want that to be moved from being an exception to being an expectation. And that's kind of a driving philosophy that I have in my approach.
Identity is a complex thing. We are not just our gender or ethnicity. And none of these identities are unaffected by the others. When I walk into a room, I'm not a Black person and a man. I'm a Black man. Identities are not additive. And being a Black man means different things in different situations. We are not just men or women, we are Asian men or white women. And this intersection is true of all of our many identities. I'm curious how your identity has affected your experience as an entrepreneur. And so how you came to occupy that space and how people have responded to you, how you've thought about yourself as an entrepreneur. Just what's the relationship between your identity and your experience as an entrepreneur?
Yeah. So interesting because there are many layers of identity, right? So there's the Julia that identifies as a Black woman. There's the Julia that identifies as a food person. There's the Julia that identifies as a climate activist. I also identify by my family, by where I was born. I strongly identify at this point in my life as a mother. So there's so many layers of my identity. I think within the context of being a founder in Silicon Valley, the place where my identity has butted up against or had the most difficulty in integrating with systems has been really my Black womanhood. That's been the place where over the arc of my sort of founding career, which for me in Silicon Valley really began in 2015, there have definitely been moments of extreme friction. Other elements of my identity were easier to integrate, the Harvard and the Stanford and the, those things didn't cause me to feel out of the pack or out of the norm. But it was very much the case that, being a Black woman founding companies in Silicon Valley for the last few years has been tremendously difficult. And if you just look at the numbers, I think less than, 0.1% of all venture activity, less than 0.1% of all venture activity was related to Black founders or Black CEOs for the last time period. And that's just startling. You hear those numbers and it's sort of like, holy moly. So where is that coming from, Brian? I think it's probably coming from just the utter lack of representation in tech investing. And we're seeing some small glimmers of hope and activity, but we really still have quite a long way to go.
Right. So what we don't often hear is the experience of people like you when you go out to raise funds. What does that feel like? How are people responding? Like, what is it that's happening on the ground that allows these disparities to continue?
I think the experiences that I had when I was first getting started really typify or are much more representative of what Black female founders and maybe just Black founders are facing when they're going out to raise. You know, one of the things that I noticed was sort of like when pitching, and I sort of compare my notes to other founders, you know, my white male friends and other folks, it was much more likely for me to get additional questions about just my ability to run the business. Much more likely to get questions about my future ability to fundraise. Like, will she be able to get a round done? Will she be able to raise follow-on capital? Much more likely for investors to ask me sort of risk aversion questions rather than sort of the big picture questions. There's also just the psychological piece of walking into a room and not seeing, you know, another person who would identify as woman, maybe even non-binary or Black. Maybe once in a while there's a person who greets you at the front door who identifies as a woman, but often you're walking into those rooms and it's a conference room that feels like it's a mile long, just full of folks who do not look like you. And so that can also just trigger some sense of, do I belong here and am I qualified to do this, even if you know intellectually that you are.
What would you want them to have done differently?
One of the easiest things that funds can do is to bring more Black investors, more Black female investors, more underrepresented investors to the table. You know, it you don't have to be a rocket scientist to be an investor. There's so many more people that are qualified to do the job than actually get the opportunity, because there's a huge amount of just bias that goes into the way that investors are building the networks and building their funds. And it's often just a pattern of having known the right people and been in the right circles. So I would have liked for them to change the composition of the room before I walked in the room. And if you don't do that, then I think it's unlikely that anything that you can do in the room will really have a big impact.
When I spoke to Oscar, he was clear about the importance of being in the room. He also talked about what it took for him to be one of the few and often the only person of color present when important decisions were being made. So as you, you know, ascended the ladder, how did you maintain your sense of community at home, and what was that like for you?
You know, to be just horrifically honest, for a period of time, not a short period of time, I avoided all of that. I needed to differentiate and distance myself in my mind. The world I lived in didn't have a lot of room for a Mexican kid that, you know, in the positions of authority and intellect required to do the jobs I was doing. And so I tended to sort of not embrace my heritage. And it's something that, you know, you don't, you know, regrets in life are an interesting conversation, but that is clearly one, because it was just, in my mind, the environment forced me to do that. And I regret having to do that. And I can't tell you how many conversations I would be in early on where remarks were being made that should not be made in today's day and age or anywhere. And I would stay silent just for fear of, hey, I just got here, you know. And then over time, I figured out a good way for me personally to approach people on an individual basis and just say, hey, Bill or Bob or whatever. It's like, you know, that comment or that joke or whatever, do you think that's really funny? And do you really mean that? And increasingly, there are more people like me in the room or that are allies, that are in alliance with us. That just continues to be an issue that you have to work through, but that it does take a little courage. Find your courage, find your vehicle and your method to do that, and measure it by the impact that you have and the success in moving forward. Saying things loudly and you know, as some people would say, militantly or whatever, that may be your way and your best way. It doesn't always move the needle. So you got to find your own method and way that does that.
To the flying public, Oscar Munoz will be remembered as the face of their frustration with air travel. Inside United, he is the CEO who got the troubled airline back in the air.
Oscar's experiences reinforces for me how incredibly hard it is to make it in places where people don't value you or people that look or talk like you. But it also shows what can be done when you make it there.
I remember the first time I landed at EWR, there was probably 50 or 60 employees cheering crazily, all Latino. The sheer pride and support that you get, you don't understand how those people for so long have never seen anyone like them, you know, in a position of authority or power, much less the CEO. But there'll always be rooms that no matter how high you've reached into the upper echelons will still be closed.
United Airlines recently pledged to train 5,000 pilots with the goal of having half of them be women or people of color.
Training to become a pilot is very time consuming, and it's kind of a narrow pathway. I think all of us felt that when people fly United in the friendly skies, they look up to our pilots with awe, frankly. I want themselves to see themselves as the possibility of being one of those things one day. So how do we do that? How do we get more people in the pipeline? So we formed this university of sorts. We call it Aviate. And we pledge that 50% of the students at any time will be women or people of color. The South Side of Chicago, you know, the concept of being a pilot today to a lot of those inner city kids, like anything else other than what they do in their neighborhood, is kind of impossible. They don't see it. There's no representation. Mothers and fathers, cousins and aunts say, well, you can't do that. It's, you know, that's too expensive. And so we want to make sure that we can have any qualified and aspiring person, you know, to earn their wings and achieve those dreams without the significant financial barriers that come along with that.
Got it. And what was the feedback? How did people, I mean, I'm sure there was a lot of positive response, but not only positive response. I'm curious how it played out when you did that.
Haters are gonna hate. And boy, did they on this one. You know, very crass, direct terms, what the hell are you talking about? I mean, because for a while it said, gee, United is having such a hard time getting pilots that they have to, like, you know, in essence, open up their qualifications to, oh my God, women and people of color. And the words were said specifically, you know, be careful flying United because the safety of your flight is going to be affected. And that's just patently false. Right? It has nothing to do with qualifications for pilots are set by, you know, federal regulatory agencies. The process, the time, the testing that has to happen is immense. We had to deal with that for a lot of time. And including some of our own internal employees who, you know, there's, you know, this whole issue of race and diversity and inclusion has two sides to it. And increasingly, the majority side of things are beginning to have the views that you've seen espoused in politics. Racial inequality and income inequality can be helped. I think a lot of these issues can be faced if people, all people, feel like they have an opportunity to move forward in some way.
Our next guest is the first Black woman to co-found a unicorn company with startup Zoom Pizza, which raised $375 million from SoftBank. Joining us now to talk about her next venture is Julia Collins, now the founder and CEO of Planet Forward, a regenerative food business.
So we've been working on Planet Forward since 2019. The mission of the company is really to help tackle climate change by making it easier to create climate-friendly products and bring them to market. We help brands very clearly understand their carbon footprint, not just their scope 1 and 2 emissions, which are frankly easier, but their scope 3 emissions, the ones that are coming from the supply chain. And that can be a bit more difficult for companies to figure out on their own. So that's what we're doing on the technology side of the business. And so in 2020, we built and launched a brand called Moonshot with a line of climate-friendly snacks. And the idea there is, one, to understand what it takes to build a climate-friendly brand, but also to get consumers excited about this idea that there's a strong relationship between what they eat and the kind of climate that they want to support, and that they really do have power as individuals to use their purchasing power to actually drive climate action. So snacks and software, but all designed to promote climate-friendly eating and also climate-friendly product creation.
I was also curious about something else that I read about Planet Forward. I noticed that your seed round of funding came almost completely from investors of color and women. How did that come about?
Yeah, you know, early in my career as a founder and early in my fundraising journey, I didn't think about the diversity of my investors or my cap table. I didn't know that I should think about it. I didn't know that I had the power to actually manifest a diverse cap table. And I think what happened for me as an individual is, since I didn't put any focus or attention on that, I looked up and I really didn't have any investors who were women or people of color. Almost none, I think one. And that was not a great dynamic for me as the founder. It made me feel as though I wasn't necessarily seen or heard in the same way that I would be with a more diverse group of investors. And so when I decided that I was going to raise money for Planet Forward, I thought, why don't I just do things differently this time? What would happen if I had investors who, you know, were more representative of the world itself? And what would happen if I had investors where I felt that there was more representation? And I'm so glad that I did that, because I will tell you that I feel closer to my investors at Planet Forward than I ever knew was possible. I feel that I can be transparent. I feel that I can come to them early on when there's a problem, instead of having to figure it all out and then telling them how I fixed it. And because I can do that, they're actually in a better position to help me. So some of it is just also the change in the mindset that happened for me when I realized that I was surrounded by more diverse people.
The challenges that we face, like the ones Julia pointed to, social inequalities and global warming, require more than the heroism of exceptional individuals. We need to change the way we do and think about business.
I think that we're at a point in our humanity when we have to recognize that we need to unlearn almost everything that we've learned. If I can really be honest with you, nothing is working. I think we need to be willing to recognize that our old thinking won't get us to the future that we all want to actually live in. And that includes the way that we think about business. So maybe the role of organizations now is to rethink what value is. And I do see glimmers of this happening in different areas, but you know, value includes not just shareholder value in terms of dollars and cents, but it also includes, you know, value in the improvement of human life, value in terms of improvement of the health of the planet, and really to sort of expand the aperture about what value means. I think the current system works very well for a very small number of people. The problem is that very small number of people yield a tremendous amount of power, political power, economic power, social power. And how do we open their eyes?
What responsibility do you think business leaders have to society, if any?
Increasingly, for the right things, you have to say something, and silence is a language. Silence is a message. How do I create enough dialogue with people who are capital allocators, decision makers, who, and just happen to be white, where they truly comprehend and understand the value proposition and the systems that create inequality and are focused on solving them? And back to the question on what responsibility leaders have, well, there's the damn responsibility, right? Do something that betters the world. And make money while you're at it, sure, but it shouldn't be exclusive of the other.
We all want to be successful. What that means and costs is not the same for everybody. We all take some aspect of our lives for granted. For some of us, that includes expectations about work. Do you assume that your experiences growing up, your life outside of work, is understood and respected? Do you expect decision makers to share your basic experiences of the world, and to assume you're as likely to succeed as anyone else? Do you wonder if your identity is an obstacle to overcome? What some take for granted in life, others view as a feature of success to strive for. For some, money might be more than just a promise of comfort. It might buy the right to have their full humanity recognized. How much would you be willing to give up for that? And that's the conundrum. What if the desire for the safety of success asks you to give up the very humanity you want acknowledged? There's a lot of talk these days about DEI and belonging, but to truly understand what an inclusive world looks like requires us to know, to see clearly what our current society is asking of all of us. That's it for this episode. I'm Brian Lowry. Know What You See is produced by PRX in collaboration with the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Our production team is Jocelyn Gonzalez and Amy Chan from PRX Productions. Executive producer from the Stanford Graduate School of Business is Bernadette Clavier, with content production by Katie Wallace. To connect with me or to check out my webinar series, follow me on Twitter at Brian Lowry, PhD. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, know what you see.